I'm Lee Campbell, and the topic I'm going to talk about today is shame, finding freedom in Christ for yourself and or helping others find freedom in Christ. Shame is kind of a complicated topic, so I think I'm going to pray. God, I thank you for the chance to do this. I thank you for my own hardship, really, in dealing with shame. Proneness and kind of an intrinsic baked-in shame, because as I've been led by you, I'm able to leave breadcrumbs for other people to help find their way out of it as well. So I just thank you for your grace. I thank you that even hard things add up to your glory, and I pray that today it would be you that gets all the attention. Amen. All right, so shame, you know what? The Merriam-Webster Dictionary has, a pretty good definition. Shame is a painful emotion caused by a consciousness of guilt, shortcoming, or impropriety. This should probably be in your notes. I've tried to give you complete notes that are even more complete than this lecture. And so what's good about this definition is it says that some shame is connected to guilt. Some shame is connected to shortcomings. It's got nothing to do with guilt, just a sense of you falling short. Like, you know, I've got a cold. I'm standing up here and I'm sweating. I might start gagging as I'm talking. Do this, right? That's a shortcoming. There's a sense of, oh my God, I must look ridiculous, right? A shortcoming. Or impropriety, having maybe done something that's socially bad, something you could do in the comfort of your own home and it wouldn't be a problem, but now you did it out in public, right? So it's an impropriety. And so this is a really good definition. Shame is one of several secondary emotions. These are called secondary emotions because the primary emotions you have from birth, until about the age of 1.5, 2, he still has them on into adulthood. The primary emotions are things like sadness, happiness, anger, anxiety, fear. These are primary emotions. Secondary emotions are ones that develop after you become self-aware. Maybe you're not aware that you became self-aware, but about around 1.5 to 2 years old, you became aware of yourself. You looked down and you saw something, and you grabbed it, and you're like, these are mine. These are my toes, right? And this is a lot of fun as a parent. If any of you have ever been a parent, you remember this time when self-awareness happens? It's really kind of cool. But it also happens, why are the twos called the terrible twos? Because this child's now become self-aware, and in self-awareness, what's come with that is an awareness, I have my own will. And I'm going to exercise it as often as I can, right? And so with this self-awareness, we begin to get secondary emotions, emotions that are about myself, of which I've just become aware. And so pride and guilt. I'm pairing these secondary emotions because they're related. So pride in this sense, I'm not using this in the biblical sense of hubris or conceit or being puffed up. I'm using pride in the sense of I accomplished something. And so, you know, the child stacks the blocks in a particular way and mom or dad yells, yay, you did it. And the child's like clapping their hands because they're prideful, not in a negative sense, in the sense of they've accomplished something, right? When you accomplish things, you feel pride of accomplishment too. You're self-aware. There's the sense I have specifically done this specific thing, and I feel pride about it. Guilt is an awareness that I have failed in some way. Not that I've accomplished, but that I failed, but it's usually specific, right? What have I done? I've lied. That's a specific failure. And so specific achievements and specific failures have these secondary emotions attached to them of pride and guilt. Hubris and shame. Now, hubris is an old-fashioned word. A lot of the Greek tragedies are based on hubris. They focus on human hubris, and this is, we could use the word conceit or the word arrogance, but hubris is this general, global sense of my awesomeness. right? I am awesome. And hubris, or that's hubris. Shame is its opposite. It's a generalized sense there's something wrong with me. I'm broken. I'm worthless. I'm unlovable. I don't matter. A sense of just I'm flawed in some profound way. Shame. Also, what comes along with this is, by the way, I should say about the word shame, that the Germans gave us the word shame. Where's Phil? Your people gave us the word shame from Shem, which means to cover, which is interesting because can anyone just automatically go into a shame posture for me? Go ahead, go. Head down. Often there's a looking to the left and down. Often there's a covering. Males more than females tend to do this. Females more than males tend to do this. Right? It's Shem. It's to cover. And why are you covering yourself? Because you're shameful. You're shameful. Now, I should say one more thing about this. The hubris and shame are internal states. So you can't always judge an external behavior as reflecting an internal state. So someone could be arrogant or act arrogant, and everyone around could say, God, they're really arrogant. And it could be hubris, but it could also be someone who's shameful and doing something called masking, where they pretend arrogance, even though internally they don't feel arrogant. They pretend it in order to escape the public humiliation that comes with it. So you can't always tell if someone's feeling hubris or shame by looking at their behavior. You have to sort of look at their behavior as a way in to finding out what's going on internally. Another set of secondary emotions that develop around this time concerns itself with rights and needs. And so for some, there's a sense of I'm entitled to have this, I need this, and there's a demanding of this. You know, the reason that twos and threes are the way they are is because the sense of entitlement comes with self-awareness, right? And there's a lot of demanding. In fact, people who behave this way on into adulthood, the psychiatrist Ralph Ankeman, that Dayton that psychiatrist calls them infantile. Right, so that term infantile comes from him and our association with him over the years. And it's that sense of I'm entitled, and so there's a tense of demanding. But some people don't demand, and so they don't feel like they're infantile. But actually what happens is they don't demand anything, but then when they don't get what they feel they are entitled to, they feel sorry for themselves. Right? I'm not going to tell you what I want for my birthday, but I didn't get it. Right? Well, it's flip sides of the same coin. They both have to do with what I'm entitled to. And these are kind of secondary emotions. And each of these, in their own right, would be worth talking about. But we're going to focus on mainly on shame today. And I think it's important for me to distinguish shames. There's different kinds of shame. It's not one thing. You can tell by the Merriam-Webster definition, it's not one thing. And so let's describe two kinds of shame. One kind of shame we'll call situational shame, shame I feel in a particular situation. And the other we're going to call intrinsic shame, and this is a kind of shameful identity someone's adopted for themselves. We'll talk about both because, you know, we need to cope with both. Sometimes situational shame is connected with guilt. You know, so I told a lie, guilt. I'm such a liar. Shame. Do you see the distinction? One goes to an identity. I told a lie, now I'm a liar. And in fact, you know, there's scripture that speaks to this. Paul uses shame. You know, how would you like to be shameless? Some people are like, yeah. You know, you don't want to be shameless. In fact, the Bible describes the worst kind of people as shameless people. You know, in the prophets and in Romans, in several letters, Paul will say, I say this to your shame. So shame is not a bad thing in and of itself. It's properly connected to guilt. You did this wrong and you keep doing this wrong and you really should be ashamed of yourself. And so it can be kind of an appropriate motivation. And, you know, in redemption, we learn that shame is dealt with. In Zephaniah 3:11, God says, "On the day you stand before me, you will not be ashamed because of the wrong things you did against me." Now, it's interesting. He doesn't say, "You're not guilty, don't or forget about it. You did wrong things, but on the day you stand before me, you won't be ashamed." Why? Well, we find out eventually that when Christ died, he died for our guilt, and he died for our shame. Right? And so there's a proper use of shame. Jeremiah chapter 3:3 and verse 8:12 talks about the shamelessness of sin. Philippians 3:19 talks about people who glory in their shame. You know, one way to deal with shame is to assemble a shame support group. You know, a group of people who are doing the same thing you are, and you all agree it's okay. Right? And so people will assemble around themselves people that are doing the same thing they're doing, or worse. And so if I can feel good, because shame is heavily connected to socialization and to social structures. So if I assemble around myself a social structure where everyone's doing the same thing, then my shame can be damped. But then I get into another social structure where people don't think and act this way, and the shame returns, right? It's one thing for me to be looking through a keyhole. I might feel guilt, like I really shouldn't be looking through this keyhole. But then I hear the floorboards creak behind me. Now I feel shame, right? I might feel shame if no one else knows, but I definitely will feel shame if someone else knows. So there's a heavy social connection to the feeling of shame. So you almost always felt when guilt is seen by others. It can be felt separately. I could look at pornography, and then I could feel ashamed of myself at the end of it, even if no one knows. But of course, if someone finds out, then I feel even more shame. There's a big social connection here. The Hebrew concept of shame, kalom, means to blush, shame, ashamed, humiliated. It's how it's translated. It's the shame associated with public humiliation, like when David's men went out as emissaries, and the enemy cut half of their beards, and they sent a message to David that half of their beards have been cut off. This is a social stigma. Public humiliation. David told them to wait in a city until their beards grew out so they wouldn't have to endure the public humiliation. They didn't do anything wrong. They were humiliated. And so humiliation or abuse or failure on the part of the one who shamed, right? So this is the Hebrew concept of shame. Hugh Grant is on the left. This is when he's having a press interview about having solicited a prostitute. I don't know why Marilyn looks like this, but she had lots of reasons to feel shame. Some of which was she was exploited sexually as a girl. And the reports of like Avedon and photographers who photographed her is that she could be lively and active in front of the camera, seductive and bright, for a period of time. And then after a while, she would just shut down. And one photographer described her as exceedingly dull. In fact, one of the Avedon's famous photographs of her, she's just like this because she'd been at it for 2 hours and she had no more energy. Of course, this is when Clinton finally admitted he did have, if you define oral sex as sex, then I guess I did have sex with that girl. You know, these are shame postures. And this is shame connected with guilt. But shame can also be connected with failure. In fact, there's the Hebrew concept here is this term bush, which means humiliation because of a failed trust. You put your trust in something, or someone was putting their trust in you and you failed, or you were putting your trust in something else and they failed. In Psalm 25:3, it says, "Those who hope in the Lord will not be ashamed." This is from this root bush. those who hope in the Lord. And a lot of times the word shame in the Bible is connected with, you know, I put my hope in you, God, and you failed me. You shamed me. You know, they say to me, where is your God? Right? Those are angry statements because they're speaking out of shame, failure. This guy had 6 consecutive kicks on goal and missed them all. Typical male posture of shame. There's Nelson from The Simpsons. You know, that guy in the corner seems shamed, especially. And so a lot of times this shame does happen because of public humiliation. This is all situational. There's also shame connected with being observed. If I were to just pick someone out in the audience and start staring at them and invite you to all stare at them too, they would begin feeling shame. Why? The simple act of being observed can trigger shame. And if you've ever had a tragedy before, the loss of a spouse or the loss of a job or something that's fairly public, and you walk into a group of people, there's a sense of, I'm in a fishbowl. Everyone's looking at me. Everyone knows about my loss. And that act of being observed stimulates a sense of shame, not in everyone, but in many people. You've got a handout called Symptoms of Shame. Is that right? I don't have it. Phil, would you mind grabbing me one of those? I don't have it in my bundle here. This is from, what's the book? Thank you. Released from Shame by Sandra Wilson. And so she sort of goes through the physiological symptoms of shame. Increased in body temperature, warm flush. I've definitely felt this as a kid a lot. I'd turn really red. I'd start sweating. Maybe a sense of nausea, heaviness in the chest, poor eye contact. People who feel shame, situational or intrinsic shame, have trouble making eye contact. Body minimizing posture, this looking down to the left, this covering the head, trying to hide the shape of your body, trying to look invisible, often low energy levels. There are cognitive symptoms of shame, like, you know, I'm an idiot, you know, just negative things you say about yourself, you fool. I bet you if I followed a lot of you with a microphone, I'd hear you saying shame things to yourself. How many people would say, I frequently have shame utterances that come out of my mouth and I don't even know they're happening. Yeah, how about that? It's a lot of you. And guilt proneness. So it's one thing to feel guilt because you've done something wrong. It's another thing to feel guilt when you didn't do anything wrong. So a lot of times when people feel shame, they also feel guilty about things they're not actually guilty for. Personalization. Every interaction feels like a commentary on your worth. And so what happens in shame is there's distorted thinking. All or nothing thinking, all issues are extreme. I'm either perfect or I'm garbage. Perfectionism, I asked someone if they were perfectionistic once. They said, not as much as I should be. And I started laughing and they looked really puzzled. They weren't trying to joke. They weren't being wry. That's actually how they thought. Always disappointed with themselves. Relational symptoms of shame. Rescuing others. Needing to be needed. Doubting that any healthy person would freely choose to relate to us. So try to find people that will. And so a lot of rescuers are shame prone. Tolerating disrespect and abuse. You know, I think sometimes, why do I feel worse about this than you do? You're the one that got humiliated here. You can go through the rest of the list. These are kind of all, there's various kinds of manifestations of shame. But there's also, I should just say, there's sometimes shame proneness. Like, if you took off my shirt right now and my big belly was here, I'd feel intense shame. I wouldn't be able to stop thinking about it for weeks. There's a guy on Mays Road who stands out front with no shirt and a giant belly smoking cigarettes right by the edge of the road all the time. You know, he's not shame prone. I'm kind of more shame prone. And so sometimes this is just how you're built. You're not really that sensitive to what's going on around you. In fact, you could possibly be a non-criminal sociopath and have no interest at all in what anyone else thinks. Right? You're not really susceptible to other people's feelings because you don't actually have any to speak of. But also we can be shame prone because we carry with us intrinsic shame, which I'll talk about in a second. And if you carry with you an intrinsic sense or something about you that's shameful, you're highly susceptible to feeling shame in situations. Right? So a shame prone person who was shamed very young in life can end up having a lot more examples of situational shame than the average bear. How many people would say, I think I tend to be shame prone? Yeah. Yeah. Me too. Let's take a second then to look at intrinsic shame. We'll get to solutions after this. Intrinsic shame is shame that is felt not as a result of a situation, but it's carried with you at all times. It's a sense that there's something about me that's wrong. I'm broken. I'm unacceptable in some manner. And this is where the psychological definitions of shame are much more articulate. Merriam-Webster's definition was great. These definitions are actually not great in the sense that they're really not broad enough. They don't cover situational shame. They don't cover appropriate shame that's connected to guilt. These cover this intrinsic shame. And speaking about intrinsic shame, they say shame is an emotion in which the self is perceived as defective, unacceptable, or fundamentally damaged. I'm a broken person. And not in the broad biblical sense of I'm a fallen person, but that I suck as a person. Lewis, from whom I'm taking a lot of this material, says shame is a global negative self-regard, often triggered by some failure or social stigma, that's situational shame, but is often rapidly used as a general negative self-assessment, accompanied with a desire to hide, withdraw, or escape. So this is what intrinsic shame looks like. And this can, a lot of things can cause a sense of sort of a baked-in sense there's something wrong with me. It could be connected with abnormality and loss. You know why I'm using a microphone? My head is so big that those wraparound mics don't fit. If you put a wraparound mic on my head, the microphone's back by my ear. In high school, they called me Buckethead, because the only football helmet that fit me was the one giant football helmet they had and a leather helmet that Newt Rockne wore. And I got the one that Newt Rockne wore, so my nickname in high school was either Buckethead or Newt, right? So that's not terrible abnormality. The abnormality that actually kind of killed me was I have a short palate. And so my voice was very nasal growing up, and kids used to respond back to me with exaggerated nasally voices, and teachers would respond back to me in classrooms with exaggerated nasally voices when I asked questions or when I tried to answer questions. And I had a period of life where I was suicidal for probably a year that was triggered by a high school teacher, asked a question, I answered, he repeated my answer back with a nasally voice and laughed. I spent a year trying to figure out how to kill myself without freaking out my parents, right? And so the sense of there's something physically wrong with me, but it's not just physical. You could feel abnormal because a parent died. You know, a 10-year-old boy who loses a mom feels shame. And part of this intrinsic shame typically is baked in early in life. Because there's something about children you need to understand. Children are egocentric. And I don't mean this in a critical way. I mean, they naturally connect the things that part of being self-aware is they think too many things are connected to them, right? So if mom dies, a boy might feel like, I think I did something to kill her. That's what I mean by egocentric. If they get sexually abused, they think, well, I heard this on the news with this chess tutor, that this one young girl, this four-year-old girl that he touched, was put her head down and was weeping when her dad asked a question about this, and she was sure she had done something to make him act this way toward her. Well, you know, when you're forming your identity at a young age and you believe you've done something to cause this to happen to you, then what gets baked into you is what? There's something about me that's dirty. There's something about me that's wrong. There's something about me that's broken. And so whether you're abused, we'll talk about things that can cause this, or whether you have suffered a severe loss, or there's something about you that's abnormal, you can, especially early in life, have this baked-in sense, there's something wrong with me. Classic posture of shame. A poor woman begging money. She's not going to make eye contact. She's dirty. She's broken, right? She's abnormal. She doesn't fit socioeconomically. And so there's this accompanied with the poverty is the sense of there's something wrong with me. I'm shameful. Now, believe it or not, these are some ads that are in their intent. The intent of the ads was to shame children into losing weight. Fat kids become fat adults. Big bones don't make me this way. Big meals do, right? And so there's actually a bioethicist who suggested the use of shame and as a social pressure to help people to become thinner. And there's probably some that would be so attuned to social pressure, they would respond to this. Maybe they would become bulimic, maybe they become anorexic, but most of these kids will just eat more and stay more and more hidden, right? This is a bad plan. You're saying you're abnormal, let's mock your abnormality and you'll be better. Not true. So there are unhelpful, whether it's situational shame or intrinsic shame, there are unhelpful shame coping mechanisms, like refusing to attend to the shame. I think a typical reaction to shame is you don't look at it. Most overweight people don't look at mirrors or reflective glass surfaces. Right? Because if I don't see myself, I don't have these triggers that make me feel ashamed of myself. So that's one way you could refuse to attend to the shame of abnormality. Or if you have a disfigurement of some kind, I'm not going to look in anything that reflects, so I don't have to be reminded that I'm abnormal and then feel alienated because of that. So how do we do this typically? I mean, there's a lot of ways that people deal with not attending to the shame. They use repressive strategies. So repressive strategies can be extreme. Like one repressive strategy that's extreme and automatic and often developed as a child is dissociation. The person who's feeling dissociated feels like something else has taken over their body. They feel like they're more of a passenger in their own body. To the person on the outside, it seems like this person is either checked out or it seems like they really have attached themselves to some extreme emotion. But this is often developed early on. The child psychiatrist Perry talked about a child who had witnessed her mom being stabbed to death. And then after the murderer left, she went to the kitchen and got milk and was trying to give her mother milk and trying to comfort her mother, and her mother, of course, wasn't coming back around. When Perry first encountered her, he walked into the room, and she immediately crawled underneath the coffee table and started rocking. And so he realized she was dissociating, and he wouldn't be able to work with her. You can't force anyone out of this. It's a highly protective state. And so he just laid on the floor until she calmed down. And so that's an extreme example of repression. But repression can also be performing. You know, I feel ashamed, and so I'm just going to go out and work and work and work and work and work and sort of outwork my shame. And so high performance. I'm not going to pay attention to the failure or the loss or the embarrassment. I'm going to go function so I can be admirable. Try to function your way out of it. For some people, the way that they repress shame is they just numb themselves out. Drink, get high, play video games, watch TV, look at sexual imagery, and masturbate, go have sexual encounters, anything to keep myself from having to attend to this. These are repressive. The thing about repression is that the shame doesn't go away. It just pops out in some other way. It pops out as rage. It pops out as suicide. It pops out, oddly enough, as narcissism. Narcissism is thought to be a reaction to shame, where the person spends their whole life in denial by being a narcissist. So if you don't deal with this directly, it'll come out somehow. There are also strategies where you can avoid attending to the shame, that is masking strategies. So this is where you kind of feel shame, but you act arrogant. Internally, you feel unacceptable, but externally, you act arrogant. This is pretending superiority, right? If you pretend superiority, you're masking shame. Or you could be like you could pretend disinterest in what other people think, even though you're very interested in what they think. This is a kind of masking. This idea of masking makes sense to you? Yeah. Or just general defensiveness. You know, if I walk into a room and I see a broken set of glasses and I say, "Who broke my glasses?" And someone says from the crowd, "You shouldn't have left them so close to the edge of the table." It's probably the glasses breaker, right? What are they doing? They're blaming me for them having broken my glasses, right? And so this is this is just general defensiveness. Someone comes at me, I either justify myself or I counterpunch. Just general defensiveness. Some way to avoid having to express, "I screwed up." If you do this kind of repression or masking or general defensiveness, you're going to end up depressed, anxious, raging, narcissistic, or even suicidal. This is how it ends up if you don't attend to it. Another thing you can do, and it's unhelpful, is wallow in the shame. Right, you either deny it or you lay down in it and you just wallow around like a pig. And this is where you become totally obsessed with your awfulness. You can't stop obsessing about or rehearsing the failure if it's a situational shame. I think especially if you have intrinsic shame, the tendency is to either repress or wallow. And so you'll just wallow. You keep going over and over again, your situational failure, in part driven by the intrinsic sense of failure. Going over and over again. Maybe you'll defend yourself. You know, you'll be going, "Oh man, I'm such an idiot. Why?" And then you'll attack them for a little while and you're like, "No, it's me, I'm an idiot." And you'll wallow around a little more in this back and forth like a rusty hinge where you're defending yourself and you're condemning yourself, awful, not helpful, or just ending up with self-loathing. You know, walking around and things come flying out of our mouth that are self-loathing statements, and it just becomes our normal. So there's shame also connected with associations. You know, we feel shame because we're connected with people who are shamed, right? So we come from a certain socioeconomic class, and we're amongst people who are from another socioeconomic class, and we feel kind of shamed because of that, or, you know, we're too fat, or we're too thin, or we're too feminine as a man, or we're too masculine as a woman, or, you know, just in some way we're connected with or associated with, you know, we have same-sex attraction. And we sort of have shame connected with that association. I think this kind of shame that it builds up intrinsically can, and I see often, is diffused by the body of Christ. Because in the body of Christ, we're to accept one another. We're not supposed to make distinctions. And even when we do make distinctions, often someone's correcting this. That, you know, we can't make distinctions. We're called on to honor those who have no honor. We're called on to take that member that is, what's that expression for that member? Unseemly member, and show them more abundant honor. You know, when Paul's using this analogy, the body of Christ, he carries this analogy to the unseemly member, you know. The member you like to cover up, you should show them more abundant honor, right? Because they have less honor. The people who are really amazing people, they get plenty of honor. Show honor to the other. So the body of Christ should really help strongly diffuse this. And I've seen this. I've seen it especially in college ministry, where people come into my office and you know, they're just odd people. And after a while, your affection kind of grows for them. But you also, what I've been noticing is how accepted they are by the people in their home group. It's beautiful. And I think in the body of Christ, this kind of thing should be eliminated if we have a well-functioning body. And then there's shame connected with abuse. You know, some people when they're young are verbally and physically abused, verbally and or physically abused. And if this happens to you as a kid, then you end up with a view of yourself that there's usually something wrong with you. Bev DeLashmet uses this expression that when someone's abused, they either feel like a victim or they feel like a survivor. They feel like they have no power or they feel like they have all power. And so they often waffle back and forth between this sense of I'm powerless and useless and worthless to I'm awesome, and just this seesawing back and forth. Neglect can produce shame. You know, what message do you get as a child, or what message do you tell yourself? And by the way, this is all happening in your emotional brain circuitry. It's not happening in your cognitive circuitry as a kid, because that part's not even developed until you're in your mid-20s. What develops early and lastingly is this emotional circuitry, and it's not really all that rational. And so people are left with the sense of shame is not a rational category. It's an irrational one. It's an emotional one. It's an intuition. It's a gut sense. There's something wrong with me that you may not even be able, maybe have never articulated. And as a kid, if you're neglected, who gets neglected? Kids who don't matter get neglected. Kids who don't count. Kids who don't amount to anything. There's something wrong with me that Dad left and never contacted me again. Right? Oddly enough, over-involvement can produce shame. Helicopter parenting can produce shame. How so? Well, if a parent is over-involved, what message does that give the kid about their own competence? They're incompetent. Now we feel shameful because we're incompetent. And you know, other things can come with this, like learning how to manipulate people and taking care of you. But, you know, there's this general sense of, I'm an incompetent person. People that have helicopter parents or abusive parents often learn to feel helpless. You know, they're in a situation where they could easily find their way out, but it seems to them that's hopeless. They can't find their way out. Trauma or loss. Of course, this can happen even in adulthood, but in childhood, an identity of the one who doesn't have the parent or the one who's lost the limb or, you know, these kinds of traumas can leave us feeling shame. Parentification of children. This is actually a psychological term. This is where sort of a emotionally incompetent parent or absent parent forces a child to begin behaving like a parent. And this parentification of children is accompanied by a long-term sense of shame. There's something, you would think it would have the opposite effect, right? That since they had to learn to be so competent as a kid, they would feel very competent as an adult, but a lot of times it just leaves them feeling shamed. And of course, the one that's most obvious is sexual abuse. Sexual abuse is a really pretty heinous kind of sin because it, Paul said, you know, about sexual sin, he said, any other sin you commit is outside of your body, but when you commit a sexual sin, it's against your own body. There's something about God created sexuality to cause oneness. And when the thing he created for oneness ends up being used for someone's gratification, it has a profound effect on a sense of who I am as a person. You know, either I feel dirty. Again, this child psychologist Perry went in to interview a young girl one time, and as soon as he entered the room, she walked up and started trying to get his zipper down. What did she learn this? What did she learn about herself? What's her function in life? Right? This is horrible, horrible sin against children. It can have huge impacts and lasting impacts. It's not hopeless, but it needs a lot of attention. This probably as much or more than anything needs professional help. So how do you deal with situational shame? I think the primary goal in situational shame, so this is shame that's happened because something came up, something happened. Maybe you did something wrong, maybe there was some failure, maybe you're connected with something that failed, is learning to turn away from the inordinate self-attention that it comes with situational shame. When you feel situational shame, you can't stop thinking about yourself. And part of dealing with this in a healthy way is to find a way to stop thinking so much about yourself. You know, the fastest way for you to feel shame is to go stare in the mirror for a while. Right? Why? Because the longer you look, the more flaws you see. The more flaws you see, the more obsessed you become with those flaws. And turning away from staring into the mirror is actually a good way to avoid that kind of shame. And situations that have led to shame, you need to learn how to turn away from that. How are we doing in terms of, where's my monitor, Phil? He's not here. I just wanted to, do you guys feel like you need a break? Okay, all right. What's that? I'm sweating like a horse, but I think that's just my illness. Thanks. I feel so ashamed. I think that one way you deal with situational shame is that you admit it. Admitting you feel shame is important. It's something I wanted to make sure I didn't miss in my notes. I need to see if I've gone past it. One moment. Okay, not yet. It's to admit your shame. And the other thing is to specify your shame. You know, the thing about shame is it's generalized, right? You get more generalized. You go from I lied to I'm a liar. So it's important if you're going to handle the shame properly is you focus it back on the incident, what actually happened. The more general you allow it to be, the more it's one thing for me to be harsh in a conversation, say I've been harsh in a conversation, I walk away feeling guilty and I feel shame. I can go back and say, you know, I was really harsh with you in that conversation. I'm sorry. Right? That's general. That's a generalized self-critique. And so it's important to sort of be real specific of what did I do wrong that I can repair, that I can fix. If the shame you're feeling is guilt-based, then you need to bring it to the cross. You need to bring the thing you did wrong to Christ and express appreciation that he atoned for that sin. And you need to confess. You know, obviously you need to confess to a mature person, you know, I did this thing that was wrong. And in this sense, you're admitting it, you're specifying what happened, you're confessing it. I have a word to say, you also ultimately need to confess the sin to the one you sinned against. But I've got a word of warning to fire up in the air for you. Believe it or not, if you confess your sin to someone, you may induce shame in them. If I say to my wife, I was unfaithful to you, she may be angry, but she also feels shame. What's wrong with me that he would go to another woman? What's wrong with me that he would have this porn addiction? Right? And so sometimes when you say to someone, you know, I got to apologize to you, man. I was gossiping about you. It's sort of like, what's so screwed up about me that gossip is confessing someone else's sin, right? So if I'm confessing I gossiped, I confessed your sin to other people, and you end up wondering, well, what sin did you confess? Now I feel shame. Thanks. And so you need to realize that if you're confessing to someone, you may induce shame in them, and you've got to give them time to process. And a lot of times there's this expectation, if I confess, I need an immediate, you're okay, I'm okay with you. And if you're confessing your sin, you've got to realize, especially as the sin is big, you need to give them time. This probably will not be a one-time thing for them. They're going to have to go back to this over and over again, iteratively, over and over. And you're going to have to give them time to process it. And, you know, they can feel shame because of the nature of the sin you sinned against them. They can feel shame because they can't figure out how to get to the point of forgiving you for it. You know, what kind of person am I that I can't forgive you for this? So now there's shame that I'm not forgiving you for having sinned against me, right? So we've got to be sensitive to the fact that our sin, you know, if I'm harsh with someone in a conversation, that's my sin, but I've also somehow communicated to them there's something wrong with them. So I just need to be aware that there's more than one person in the room that could be feeling shame at this moment. And I need to give them time to wrap their mind around it so they can find their way out. Look at that. I've got two waters and a wad of Kleenex. I must really look like I'm in distress. Do what you can to repair the damage. You know, the thing about shame is that there's nothing to repair because it's such a global negative self-critique. What are you going to fix? But the more you can specify, what did I do wrong in this situation, the more you can work to repair the damage that was done. But if it's not guilt-based shame, it's still important to admit it, and it's important to specify it. My wife said, do you have a lot of examples of me in this teaching? I only have one. She, all women, when they go away on retreats, say, what's your most embarrassing story, right? Why do we do that? It's a way to get to know people. It's a way to get toward intimacy. The question she'll ask people often is, are you in the poop your pants club? Have you ever pooped your pants? And a lot of people actually have pooped their pants. They didn't mean to, but they did. And there's something about, I mean, this isn't moral, right? If you're in the poop your pants club, welcome. But admitting it and specifying it is actually a way to diffuse it. Instead of walking around feeling, I'm a pants pooper. I think it's important, too, to get reoriented. See, the thing about shame is that it's intensely self-focused. You've got to get your head out of yourself and onto something else. You have to shift your attention onto something else. And so you get reoriented. You get reoriented by meditating on and preferring God's point of view. Right? It's not enough to know that God accepts you. You've got to prefer his verdict over your own. You know, I like what, I think it's in your notes, but I don't have it on the screen. Is it Paulison? Yeah, Paulison in his book, Making All Things New, says, sin turns you in on yourself, blinding you to God. Self-loathing exalts your opinion of yourself as supremely important. Self-condemnation, shame exalts the opinion of other people. But what God chooses to remember about you is decisive. Your conscience, if well-tuned, is dependent on the stance he takes. And so part of dealing with this situational shame, ultimately part of dealing with intrinsic shame, is you begin to reflect on and meditate on God's point of view. I'll say this probably a little later, but I'll say it here too. I used to wake up every morning and a flood of failure stories would flood through my mind, my personal failure. Social faux pas, sins I'd committed that I was ashamed of, things from 20 years ago, things from yesterday. And it was so intense and so overwhelming that my morning routine included preventing myself from smashing my head into the wall. Because that's what I wanted to do. And this is how I coped with it. Shower, brush your teeth, eat breakfast, start thinking about your day. do not attend to it. But then the next morning, the same thing would happen. And so what happened, actually, oddly enough, for being an old man, this happened just a few years ago. I began to meditate. I memorized and began to meditate on Psalm 23. Why? Because Psalm 23 is about the reader, but it has absolutely nothing to do with the performance of the reader. You don't even have to be a sheep. It presumes you are a sheep. It doesn't matter if you're a good sheep or a bad sheep. That's not part of the psalm. What's in the psalm is you belong to him, and he's committed himself to doing things with and for you. You are his. And so as I meditate on this, so this is how I approach it in three runs. I recite it, I fight it, and I affirm it. Recite, fight, affirm. The recitation part is I just run through the memory verse in my head. The fight it and affirm it part are prayer things. The fight part is, I hope, obviously, when I get to spots in the psalm where I don't really believe this is true, right? Yahweh is my shepherd. I shall lack nothing. And I'm sitting there in the morning thinking, I lack everything. And so I'll say to him, you say I lack nothing, but I don't believe that's true. I think I lack everything. I'm fighting this affirmation, right? So I go through and I fight everything that I feel like I don't really agree with. It's not like he didn't know, but it's really helpful for me to admit. And then I go through it a third time and I affirm. I say, even though I don't believe, I don't see evidence that I have, I'm lacking nothing, I'm going to prefer to believe you'll take care of me, right? So I affirm it. And so I found that meditating on my identity in Christ was helpful but not as powerful as meditating on God and what he was like. I realized that when God is big, his verdict is bigger. And so as I let him, as the Simpsons put it, embiggen, then what he thinks about me gets bigger too. And so meditating on preferring God's point of view over others, that preference part's really important. I can meditate forever on my identity in Christ and God's commitment to me, but if it doesn't matter to me, it doesn't make any difference. I have to decide to prefer it over the opinions of other people. In a sense, I have to repent of my idolatry of the opinions of others. I have to repent of my idolatry of my own opinion to prefer his. This is what 1 Corinthians 4 and a good study of 1 Corinthians 4 should reveal. that Paul was able to be in extremely shameful situations where the people in that town thought he was a pussy, and everywhere he went, they thought he was scum of the earth, and he put 2 years of his life into a church and the wheels are coming off, so there's project failure, there's personal rejection, there's being despised by other people. How was he able to keep going back? Because he said it didn't matter what he thought, and it didn't matter what anyone thought. What mattered is what God thinks. And God's going to examine everyone's work, including their motives, sounding bad. And then each one will receive their commendation. Paul sunk his roots into the fact that he had nothing to look forward to but praise from God. And once he sunk his roots into God's verdict, then what he thought about himself or what other people thought about him grew strangely dim, as that song says. You know, turn your eyes on Jesus, look full in his wonderful face, and the things of earth will grow strangely dim in the light of his glory and grace, right? Turn your attention from yourself to someone or something else. Is this repression? Am I now urging you? Actually, repression's good. No, because with repression, you're not admitting this shame, you're not specifying the shame, you're just trying to ignore the shame. And this is, you've admitted it, you've specified it, you've done what you could, and now you're going to direct your attention somewhere else. Because the danger of shame living is that you will become self-obsessed. The trouble with our culture, it's becoming increasingly narcissistic, in part because it's becoming increasingly self-obsessed. And really, the one thing that Ralph Ankman, the Dayton psychiatrist, says that is spot on true is that you're going to become mature when you develop a positive love output. You know, oddly enough, the way through shame, apart from admitting and specifying it, is that you become a lover. And you spend less time thinking about yourself. And laughing about it. This is the whole point of the poop. Are you in the poop your pants club? Is laughing about it. I think if someone struggles with intrinsic shame, this can seem, why would you ever do this? This seems ridiculous. But I'm not talking about intrinsic shame. I'm just talking about shame over situations. I was standing in a store one time behind this woman, and as I'm standing there waiting, I look down because she's got black clothing on, and something caught my eye. And I look down, she's got this long thing of toilet paper hanging out of the back of her pants. And I'm like, what do I do? And so I leaned forward and I said, ma'am, I don't mean to embarrass you, but you got a long thing of toilet paper hanging out of the back of your pants. And she, you know, she pulled it out. And she wasn't shame prone, so she started waving it around. I would have pulled it out, wadded it up, and walked out the front door and come back to the store another time. Right? But, so for her, she could laugh about it right on the spot. For other people, it may take a little while, but, you know, I walked around all day and my zipper was down. Some people might be like so humiliated by that, but sharing it with someone laughing about it diffuses it, right? It you're kind of joining the laughers when you laugh at yourself. And when you join the laughers, it takes you out of the spotlight and it takes you away from that feeling of being in the spotlight. So some of you don't like to laugh at yourself. Might be a good thing for you to do. You could form your own Poop Your Pants Club. You could contact Debbie Campbell if you want any information about how to conduct meetings. All right. Now, with intrinsic shame, this sort of baked-in sense, there's I'm broken, I'm wrong, I'm shameful, I'm disgusting, I'm dirty, these kinds of things that frequently happen to us when we're quite young. This can be kind of a challenging area. I think a lot of times we notice people have intrinsic shame by noticing how extreme their reactions are to situational shame. right? They have like a level 10 reaction to a level 5 shame incident. How do you deal with that? I think, you know, again, there's a general thing with situational shame is we need to really become less self-attentive. And I think maybe the general goal with intrinsic shame is we need to learn to live from God's perspective, not the perspective that got baked into us when we were young. That's the general goal. But how do you get there? I think this is where it's important to point out that a counselor may be needed. Counselors, even pastoral counselors, but certainly licensed clinical social workers and psychologists are familiar with this kind of intrinsic shame, and they have different ways of dealing with it. Some deal with it by providing alternative positive self-affirmations, which can be useful, but a lot of times it's sort of like the guy on Saturday Night Live, you know, I'm smart enough, I'm, you know, handsome enough, and by golly, people like me. And I think with someone who's intrinsic shame, it can kind of feel like you're putting veneer over poop. You know, there's a pretty outside, but the inside still feels kind of not that pretty. Another approach that is typically used by professional counselors is cognitive behavioral therapy. Since intrinsic shame is kind of baked into your emotional circuitry and your rational circuitry don't operate at the same time. They often don't even talk to each other. And so this intrinsic shame can kind of be an intuition, a gut feeling. It's hard to use words to think your way out of it. But a cognitive behavioral therapist can basically have you put on a lab coat and get out a clipboard and have you begin evaluating your self statements, whether they're true or not. How sure are you this is true? And cognitive behavioral therapy is actually a very successful and effective therapy against shame. And so I don't diminish it a bit. I would say that the Bible also has an approach to dealing with this kind of shame that is also effective, but a counselor may be needed. How do you know if a counselor is needed? If the reaction intensity to triggers is extremely high, if the frequency of reacting is extremely high, it may be that they need to see a professional counselor, or at least a pastoral counselor initially. If their obsessiveness about an event, they just can't stop talking about the event. You know, a month later, they're still talking about it, and it seems as real to them a month later as it did at the moment. That obsessiveness is kind of an indicator maybe they need to see someone. If they're self-medicating, if they're smoking a lot of weed, if they're, they're drinking excessively, if they have become really obsessed with pornography, TV, gaming, anything that keeps them numb, any repressive strategy. It's probably, you know, alcoholism may be a problem, but the shame may be the driver behind the problem, and they might need some professional help. If there's chronic relational alienation, people who deal with intrinsic shame typically develop a huge personal world and a very small public life. And so if they're chronically relationally alienated from people, you got someone in your home group and you realize, man, they're just always at odds with someone. There's always someone that's screwing them over, and they're really kind of disruptive because they're fighting all the time or they're obsessing all the time. It might be time to suggest, you know, it seems like there's something going on here that's an old injury, and maybe we need to go have you consider talking with someone about that. If there's difficulty functioning, they can't hold a job. They can't function socially very well. They can't function, you know, they come to home group and they keep going outside and, you know, smoking cigarettes and pacing around, and they come in and then they go back outside and they smoke cigarettes and pace around, and they have really trouble functioning in a group. They can't seem to hold down a job. They can't hold down a job for long. Every time they have a job, there's problems. These are probably indicators that the person dealing with intrinsic shame probably needs a pro to help them with it. The role you can play as a friend is find out what they're doing in the sessions and try to help them get their homework done. If they need to interact with someone, you could be the person they interact with. You could certainly pray for them. Helping them succeed. It could be you could use some of the things I'm about to describe with what I'm about to describe using is probably maybe more for those who have subclinical intrinsic shame, that maybe it's not intense enough, obsessive enough, dysfunctional enough that they need a counselor, but they need the help. And you could still use these techniques, even with someone who's also seen a counselor. Maybe the best thing you could do is to cooperate with what the counselor's doing. But let's say it's subclinical, or you can't tell. I mean, these aren't crisp boundaries, right? It's a little fuzzy sometimes. A lot of times you could try these things I'm about to suggest, and if things makes things worse, or at least it doesn't make things better, then maybe that's a time to suggest clinical counseling. Journaling, in order to see the patterns. So I've got a handout. I think I've got a handout, a journaling handout for you, yeah. And it says on the right-hand column, journaling guidelines. I'm just going to read through it with you. This kind of journaling involves noticing when you have strong feelings, troubling thoughts, or behaviors, writing them down and exploring them, including what triggered them. So maybe you find that you're anxious, so you write down, I'm feeling anxious, right? That's that feeling box. Then you ask, what happened when I was feeling anxious? That is, what's the trigger? What triggered this? Write it down. Ask yourself, what thoughts are in my mind when this happened? That's when I felt anxious. Write those thoughts down. Ask, what did I do? What did I say? That's a behavior. When I felt and thought this way. And depending on the person, some people are going to notice their feelings first. Some people aren't going to notice their feelings first. They're going to notice their behaviors first. He said this, I punched him in the nose, right? That's the thing they first notice. So you start with that behavior and you go backward. What were you thinking or what did you feel when that? Well, obviously I felt angry. I punched him in the nose. Okay, good, you felt anger. What happened that you know? And so wherever someone starts, just help them work their way around this little feelings, behaviors, thoughts, circle or triangle or whatever shape comes to your mind when you look at it. Over time, as they do this or you do this, you're going to begin to notice patterns that you have anxiety or anger or sadness or you feel devastated or you feel bored. And these patterns are going to help answer a question. What you're going to notice over time is I'm always feeling this feeling. I frequently have these thoughts. This is kind of my little quiver of behaviors I pull out whenever I'm feeling and thinking this way. And you realize, okay, this is a pattern. And as you look at these patterns, you can ask yourself the question, what must I believe that I keep feeling and thinking and acting this way? What is it about these triggers that threaten to maybe expose this belief? What belief is being exposed when they say this? What is it that I want? This would be what I have a core desire. What is it I want so much? Like a lot of times when people feel intrinsic shame, that might be a core feeling, right? I'm shameful, I'm unwanted, I'm unlovable. That may be a core feeling, a core shaming feeling. They usually have the opposite desire. Like for me, I guess my core feeling, this is describing my flesh, this is how I came out baked from my youth, is that there's something about me that's shameful. The accompanying desire was actually to never have to feel shame. But sometimes I also had an accompanying desire to be admired and desired. And so anyone who met me, especially in graduate school, would have thought I was an arrogant ass. And when I first came around Xenos, people kept saying to me, you're such an ass. Right? So, you know, typically today people would say he's a narcissist. But internally it didn't feel like that. Internally it felt like I was always just dodging the bullet of being shamed And dude, I even want to stay around here because the more people know me, the more threatening it becomes that I'm going to be shamed. And so that was kind of my internal life. Well, also what you usually do, if you look at the behaviors, you know, see that behavior category? Those behaviors often are just revealing core strategies, right? So what was my behavior? Become really good in some really narrow field and only interact with people on that thing. Don't do anything risky. Don't do anything where you might your competence might be bad, because then you would feel shame. You wouldn't just feel incompetent at platform diving. You would feel like you were ashamed. You were there's something that you're just a complete dork. That's what you would feel. So stay away from things you don't know anything about. Concentrate all your energy on what you do know about. If you do something sinful, do not let anyone know. If someone suspects you're doing something sinful, deny. Hide, deny, conceal. It got to the point where it didn't matter if I was doing anything wrong or not. If someone had a look on their face like they disapproved of something, I would hide it, even if it wasn't moral. And so this became these are my core strategies. Lie, hide, avoid, function in where you're good. And that's sort of, that was the broken down house I lived in as a non-Christian and as a Christian early on. And so by journaling, you can end up sort of discovering these things. I didn't have journaling when I was around that time. I just had God bringing me face to face with failures. And, self-righteousness is often accompanies someone who's shame-based, right? Because they're so focused on their bad performance, they're also focused on their good performance. They hide their failures. They bring forward their successes. It's from an outsider's perspective, it's self-righteousness. And really, from an objective perspective, it's self-righteousness too, right? It's righteousness based on me. And someone said to me one time, I heard you were self-righteous. And I was so pissed off. And I thought, who said that? I know who said it. You know, this guy said it. He doesn't even know me. I spent 24 hours obsessing, you know, that obsessiveness, obsessing about this. I heard you were self-righteous. And I was a graduate student at the time at OSU, and I usually would eat lunch in the stairwell because you don't encounter anyone there. It's a good place to avoid people. And I'm muttering to myself as I'm eating my tuna fish sandwich. And I'm like, I'm not self-righteous. Self-righteous people admit their sin in general, but they can never admit their sin in particular. I know my sins in detail. They are. And my mind was blank. And then the Spirit started revealing lies that I'd told, sexual sins I'd gotten in, thievery that I'd done, cheating that I'd done, and this whole pile of sins started pouring out, and it just broke my heart. And I thought, oh my God, I'm self-righteous. I didn't have a way to deal with where this was coming from, but I didn't have a way to deal with sort of the engine and transmission that were driving it. But over time, God revealed what was driving it, the sense of being shameful, that got revealed. And so, you know, in his mercy, he's helped me fumble through the dark and find my way to a better spot. But I can still live in this house anytime I want. It doesn't take that much to trigger me to go back to that house. But sanctification means I'm living in a different house with a different foundation, right? There's a different core. You know, I choose to believe more often than not what he says about me. I choose to focus much less on myself than on him and his glory. I can attend to other people. That's the foundation for my new house. It's a better house. It's a bigger house. I can be out with my faults in this house and not be overly concerned about it. But it doesn't take a lot. It just takes a failure. You know, when I got stepped down from a position I had here in Xenos, I couldn't bear to be around other people. I felt almost panicky about being around other people because they were going to, you know, look at me and, oh, that's the failed guy. And so I can go live in that house again. I just don't go there as often. I don't live there as long. And I can find my way out. Right? And so sanctification doesn't look like the house goes away. It just looks like you don't live there as much. And so part of journaling is to see the patterns. And once you see the patterns, you have to sort of say, understand, this is in my fleshly core, this is what I believe and this is what I want. And these are the strategies I developed for getting rid of it. So having seen that, you need to replace the core. And of course, it's ridiculous. You're never going to replace the core till Jesus comes back. That broken down house is still out there somewhere for you to live in, probably right next door to the big good house. But you can begin to live in the other. So if you look at this handout entitled Strengthening Your Faith or Replacing the Core, so that same pattern that was on the left is still there. But this Strengthening Your Faith column is concerned with how do you begin replacing, or how do you lay down foundation for a new house to live in. One is you begin to meditate on and prefer God's point of view. For instance, your relationship with God as something that defines you, as something that you prioritize. And this is why Psalm 23 is so important to me. This is why meditating on 1 Corinthians 4 is so helpful, is you have to begin to cultivate and prefer what God says. Start depending on what he provides. And, you know, one of your strategies you learned growing up, or a core strategy, is I've got no one to depend on but me. You're like a street kid, right? Who's going to look after me? I have to look after me, and this is how I'm going to do it. But as you begin developing a different foundation, you realize, actually, all the things I've attended to, God will be happy to attend to. I can go focus on something else now. And so, thinking about the provisions of God, this is where Bible study is so important, especially if it's targeted toward that old, replacing that old foundation. And of course, one thing that's, I think, underemphasized is focusing your attention on the glory of God. Why? Because, I've said this before, but I feel like it's important to keep saying it. We talk about indicatives and imperatives here. That God says to love because I first loved you. He says to forgive because I've forgiven you. And he says that I will provide the strength you need to do the work that I've called on you to do. And so we think of God's provisions, that's that second bullet, as the means by which we can follow God's imperatives. But do you realize that a gigantic indicative in the Bible is he's worth it? That we do things not just because he provides, but because he's worthy. He's worthy of our full attention. He's worthy of our full devotion. And in fact, we're very small in the scheme of things. It's not that we don't matter, but we matter so much less than we think. And one of the great reliefs of standing before him in heaven is we shrink down to our proper place and we're going to be happy there. And part of getting sanctified is we shrink down to our proper place. I don't matter that much. When we're young, we're worried about what everyone thinks. When we get older, I don't care what anyone thinks. And when you get to be my age, you realize no one was thinking about you. It's true. When you get to heaven, you realize you matter, but not in the way you thought. He matters. He matters most. And you're happiest when you're glorifying him, when you're bringing attention to him. If you could walk out of a room having left people thinking about God, that's such a win, and that's such a mature position to take. If I can just get them to think about God. You know, I still sit in CTs and wonder if the teacher's going to say something about me. I mean, I'm such a dork. Really? I'm looking for glory from a teacher instead of the glory that comes from the one and only God. I could give God glory, but God also gives me glory. I mean, Jesus said to the religious leaders in John 5 in the 40s somewhere, he said, you can't even believe me because you seek glory from one another instead of the glory that comes from the one and only God. It's not wrong to seek glory. It's wrong to seek it from people. And a shame-prone person is obsessed with what people think. It's an idolatry. And as sorry as I can feel for someone who's been baked to feel shame, part of me realizes there's a moral problem with this, in that they have put in the place of God human beings. And part of the way they find their way out of it is having someone understand enough to walk through it with them. But part of the way they get freedom is that they stop looking to people or themselves for a positive evaluation. They start looking to God. And frankly, they spend, if you look at the whole Gospel of John, of which that line is one piece, Jesus' full-time job was bringing attention to God. He was devoted to seeking the glory of God. You want to know what God is like? Jesus was God in the flesh. What was he like? He was always bringing glory to the Father. The Father's always bringing glory to the Son. The Spirit's bringing glory to the Father and the Son. The Son's bringing glory to the Spirit. C.S. Lewis described this as an infinite dance, where the only rule of the dance is each member of the Godhead puts the other in the middle and extols them. And you want to join this dance? There's one rule. You put him in the middle, and he'll put you in the middle. Understanding the priority of seeking God's glory is going to provide so much relief from this obsessive question of what people think. If you go to the glory of God first without helping someone walk through these other things, you're really not that helpful. You're just adding another reason for them to feel shame. So don't be foolish. You know, if someone has this baked into them, it's not something that you can just go plowing into and pull out one thing and say, do this and everything will be okay. You know, you have to be able to walk with people long enough to find the threads to pull. So I guess I had all this on the slide. Meditate and begin to prefer God's point of view on your relationship with him, his provisions, his glory. Identify with your spirit instead of your flesh. A lot of times we say I, and then what follows the word I is everything that our flesh has to say. You know, I'm such an idiot, I'm so stupid, I feel dirty. We're identifying with the flesh. But the thing that's kind of beautiful about Romans 7 is Paul's not identifying with his flesh. He describes it in third person. He says, my flesh. So I could say to you, if I were to frame this to you, I would say it like, I would say to someone, you know, when I confess my sin to them, my flesh wants to run away. My flesh wants nothing to do with you. My flesh wants to go find something else to do. My flesh wants to get drunk. My flesh wants to, and I'm talking about my flesh in third person. What am I doing? I'm doing what Paul did in Romans 7. It's not just a mind trick. It's a choice. I'm choosing to identify with some other thing that God also put in me, and that's the Spirit. In my spirit, I want to be able to sit here and be open with my faults. I want to admit what I did wrong. I want to specify it. I want to fix it. So learning how to identify, learning and practicing, I still do this today. I'll say I, and it'll be some flesh commitment, and I'll say, okay, that's not actually me. The one who wishes to follow God, that's my flesh. It's very helpful because when you stop identifying with your flesh, you stop protecting it. And you can actually step back from it and say, God, look at my flesh, it's just screaming right now. Look at it, look at it. I saw people do this early on in Xenos, and I don't know if it was studied or if it just came out that way, but a lot of old Christians around here will use language like this now, and it's you got to listen to them. It's a powerful way to see yourself. Let your I want refer to what the Spirit wants instead of what your flesh wants. Welcome. Look at that. CBCD threats. What's that? Core belief, core desire threats. So if I'm in a situation where I'm going to be critiqued, now if my boss says, Lee, I need to see you in my office tomorrow morning, you know, my flesh is like, there's this alarm that goes off in the old broken down house and I run over there. And and I start pulling the levers I pulled my whole life. Like, I start making arguments against, you know, possible critiques that are coming my way. You know, I get myself ready for the encounter, you know. But there's a point at which I'm like, where the hell am I? I'm in that old house, and I can walk next door to the new house, and I can say to God, thank you for this opportunity to live from what you say instead of what people say. Thank you for this opportunity to get unaddicted to the tyranny of the opinions of myself or other people. I can welcome things that I used to find ways to avoid as God's gift to free me. He intends to free you. And honestly, I'm sorry to say this, the way that he's going to often free you is by bringing direct threats to that old foundation. I told someone that one time who felt like he was unlovable, and he left my office, he got out in the parking lot, and his girlfriend called him and broke up with him. And because he understood this, he laughed. He stood there and he laughed. He came back in to tell me, you're right, God was listening. What happened? He welcomed the threat. And in welcoming the threat, you know, he got some freedom from that. It's not that he didn't feel bad later, I'm sure, but it's an important, great first move. And lastly, I guess, take risks to your core beliefs and core desires. I don't mean take any old risk, like, you know, I would be really ashamed if I were naked, so you know what, I'm stripping down right now. Take a look. You know, that would be definitely a threat, but it wouldn't be God's will. And it wouldn't be edifying, you know, for you. It would be a taking a risk that aligns with God's will. You know, like, I can't imagine teaching this home group, or I can't imagine working with people in a rest home, or I can't imagine working with kids because it's a direct threat to that core. Maybe you should go ahead and take that risk, because God will free you in you taking risks like that.